Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the integration of antibody-drug conjugates into the treatment of hormone receptor-positive and triple-negative metastatic breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Laura Huppert from the University of California, San Francisco. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. And during this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more. To begin, I asked Dr. Huppert to provide a general overview of the structure and function of antibody-drug conjugates.
At a very basic level, what an ADC is it's sort of a way to targeted form of chemotherapy is how I explain it to patients. So there's a target that is on the surface of the breast cancer cell, like TROP2 or HER2, where the breast cancer cells express some amount of this protein on the surface of the cell. And the target is kind of has a linker to a chemotherapy payload. So it's pulling the payload where it needs to go. And so, you know, traditional chemotherapies kill any rapidly dividing cell and don't have a preference for any particular type of cell. But the whole goal of ADCs is, can we sort of pull that chemo payload closer to the cells where it needs to be so that we can ideally improve efficacy and then also decrease toxicity? At the end of the day, it is still a form of chemotherapy, which I tell my patients, because it has many of the same side effects as chemotherapy, and it does have off-target side effects as well, right? So things like ILD, things like stomatitis, some of these receptors are expressed on other cells in the body, and so you're seeing some of these off-target side effects as well. But we have seen that this kind of technology has really improved our ability to get the chemotherapy where it needs to go. I think one thing about ADCs, sort of looking at this diagram, so how ADCs work is, so this is an example looking at sacituzumab govitecan, and it has the target there is TROP2. And so here's the TROP2 receptors on the surface of triple negative breast cancer cells, for example. And so the drug will localize towards these cells and will be actually brought in intracellularly into the endosome and the lysosomes, and they're broken down. And then that payload is released. And then that payload then subsequently is able to kill that breast cancer cell. One thing that's really interesting about ADCs is there is this thing called bystander effect, where you get some release of this even outside in the extracellular area. And so you have the ability to really impact the surrounding cells as well and have an even greater tumor killing for that reason. But I think the mechanisms of resistance, just diving into this diagram a little bit more, is that if you have resistance to the target, let's first look at this right one. If the cancer cell is able to sort of change that TROP2 target, the ADC is not going to be able to localize as well to these cells. And so you're not going to be able to get as much intracellular trafficking of the molecules. You still have some potentially because of that bystander effect, but that could be one way in which the tumor cell can sort of evade these molecules. And then in terms of mechanisms of resistance to the payload, maybe the ADC can be localized to the cell. The TROP2 is still not mutated. It gets inside the cell. But then the cell has a way in which it's creating mechanisms of resistance to the actual chemotherapy particle, where the chemo is not working as well anymore. In an individual patient, you can actually see both. There was an interesting study done at MGH where it was a live autopsy study in a patient that was getting sacituzumab govitecan. And so this patient had generously donated their body to science. And in a single patient that had received SG, they could detect actually mechanisms of resistance to both the target and the payload in different organs. So there were some areas of the tumor where you were seeing actually both. And that's why it's, I think, going to be challenging for us in clinic. There's not going to, I think, be one test where we can know, is this target, is this payload, how should we act? Because this tumor heterogeneity might be that there's different populations of tumor cells where you have one or the other or both. And so that's why I think makes the need for sort of novel targets and novel payloads particularly important, where you're completely switching up the mechanism.
It seems like most, or I don't know, maybe all, I don't know, of the ADCs right now have TOPO1 payloads. Are there any other payloads that we have available right now? And also, what about non-chemotherapy payloads?
Yeah, great question. So yes, all three of the ADCs approved for hormone receptor positive and triple negative breast cancer have TOPO1 inhibitor payloads. With Dato-DXd and T-DXd have the exact same payload, in fact, the DXd payload, whereas SG has the SN38, but it's still sort of that same class. There are a number of ADCs in development with novel payloads. As I mentioned before, about half of the ADCs in development or more still do have the Topo 1 inhibitor payload, but there's an interest in having novel payloads like auristatin, MMAE payloads, or non-chemotherapy payloads, as you mentioned. So can you have radioisotopes? Can you have other molecules attached that can act besides just chemotherapy particles, immunotherapy compounds, et cetera? So a lot of interest in sort of using the same idea of the target and payload, but switching out the payload to bring novel agents into it as well.
So again, before we get into specifics related to sequencing, which I think is really the biggest question I hear from general medical oncologists, and we'll get into both hormone receptor positive, triple negative, but also maybe you can just talk a little bit from your own clinical experience as well as the data in terms of the tolerability toxicity issues that come up with these three ADCs and clinically how you approach preventing and managing toxicity.
Yeah, absolutely. So for T-DXd, I think the most common side effects that we see in clinic are nausea and fatigue. And I think for the nausea, the use of a triplet IV antiemetic regimen really makes a difference. And then the use of PO antiemetics, including I like to use olanzapine, even like 2.5 or 1.25 if patients are feeling fatigued in the morning from it, really makes a difference. I have patients start that on day one and continue it through the 7 days. But if they're having prolonged nausea, you can even continue it beyond that. Sometimes I will bring patients back on day 7 for fluids and IV antiemetics if they do need more. And then, of course, you can dose reduce if they're having more severe nausea. The fatigue is a little bit more challenging. I think dose reductions or dose delays are most commonly utilized to help with the fatigue, particularly those patients that have been on T-DXd for a long time. And then the ILD is a critical issue to manage. And I think a lot of patient and nursing and support staff counseling about what to look out for. In the trials with T-DXd, they typically got CT scans every 6 weeks, which isn't really that feasible, I think, in the real world setting. In general, I actually try to get them every 9 weeks for the first year. And then after that, feel comfortable spacing out to every 12 weeks if they haven't had a recurrent ILD where I'm retreating. If I am retreating with a grade one ILD, I will kind of still keep it at the 9 week interval. And then use of steroid, you know, if a patient has grade one ILD where you see it on imaging, but they have no symptoms, you're going to hold that dose of T-DXd, give steroids, like a 3 or 4 week taper. And so they basically miss that dose and then bring them back 3 or 4 weeks later, get a repeat CT scan. If the repeat CT scan shows improvement, it doesn't even have to show full resolution, but improvement, then you are able to retreat that patient at the same dose. You don't have to dose reduce the first time necessarily. If it's happened multiple times, I will dose reduce. But I think, you know, critically important, that's why I put in the slides the T-DXd rechallenge, because in our UCSF study, it was really interesting. The patients who were rechallenged stayed on it for, you know, over 200 days. So if you are able to rechallenge and they are able to stay on it, you can really derive a lot of meaningful benefit in those patients. And then if a patient has grade 2 or higher ILD, the recommendation is not to rechallenge.
How hard a rule is it in your mind to not use T-DXd again with the grade 2? Any situations where you would do it? Have you done that?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And especially in the winter when there's a lot of viruses going around, it can be really hard to tell if is this ILD or is this a virus or COVID. So I do a pretty kind of deep dive asking the patient, you know, any sick contacts, any reason that it might not be ILD, it could be something else. I've especially rechallenged patients in those kind of scenarios where it's ambiguous, like with caution. I think you don't want to forego the opportunity to treat them. But if you are really convinced it is T-DXd ILD, then I wouldn't recommend it for grade 2. But in those ambiguous cases, I think proceeding with caution if you have another potential alternative.
So let's talk a little bit about Dato and SASE in terms of tolerability. And all, it kind of seems that certainly, I guess, in ER-positive disease, it seems like the efficacy is very similar. I guess we're still waiting on data in the triple-negative situation. I'm not sure what you're expecting, but I guess could be quite possible that's going to show equivalence. And then it's going to come down to toxicity and also convenience.
Right.
So can you kind of compare the two from both of those perspectives and in situations where, you know, kind of they're both potential options, how you decide between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. So in general, for patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease, I prioritize the use of T-DXd because the data looked so good. And so then really it's in that at post-T-DXd setting where I'm choosing between SG and Dato-DXd. And it, as you said, it does come down to differences in schedule, side effects. And then the one difference between the data is we did see a demonstrated overall survival benefit with SG, whereas we didn't see it with Dato-DXd, but there was sort of more ADC crossover in the latter trial. So again, you know, really hard to know, to compare directly. But the way I think about it is I tell patients we have two great options. The main side effects with SG are the diarrhea, fatigue. It does cause alopecia in almost all patients, and then the neutropenia. It is given 2 weeks on, 1 week off. And so if patients are coming from really far, you know, the travel schedule, you know, can be more of a limitation. Dato-DXd, the main side effects are some nausea, fatigue, as well as the stomatitis, which requires the steroid mouthwash. The ocular toxicity is pretty rare, but monitor for that. And then the low risk of ILD, about 4%. If a patient's had prior ILD on T-DXd, between the two, you know, SASE doesn't have a risk of ILD, so I would go with SG in that case. Otherwise, you know, the schedule, the side effects, I think you kind of choose with each patient. The Dato-DXd, one advantage is it's given every 3 weeks. So for those patients that are coming from further, it might be more convenient to come less often. So, you know, up until now, I've sort of presented both options and then sort of made a joint decision with each patient based on the side effect profile and preferences.
In terms of sacituzumab, I'm curious about your thoughts about the PRIMED study that looked at preemptive use of antidiarrheals as well as growth factors in patients getting SASE, showing that it seemed to help, but I'm curious what you thought about it and whether or not you use either one of these strategies preemptively.
Yeah, it's a great question, and that was a really nice study. I think more and more we're using growth factor preemptively now, and it's actually now in the label to use primary prophylaxis. There's different ways you can do it. I often do, if I can get insurance auth of the long-acting growth factor, just so that it's done, and then your patients aren't having to give themselves as many shots. Sometimes you can't get that covered, or patient preference. You can also use short-acting, using it between day one and day eight for a certain number of days, and then also between day eight and the next cycle. So you have kind of both options, and I will do that sort of as primary prophylaxis in most patients, particularly if they've ever needed growth factor before. And then the diarrhea, I'm at this point mostly doing as needed, and not necessarily. You can make people be pretty constipated if you're doing too much prophylaxis for the diarrhea, but we give them Imodium off the bat to have at home and then counsel them on the use of it.
Getting over to Dato, I'm curious, you talked about mucositis, and I was we did a program recently with Erica Hamilton, and she was very, I haven't heard anybody else be as emphatic about this, but she was very emphatic about the use of preemptive mouthwash, saying that once they get mucositis, it's very hard to treat, and the patients, a lot of times, if they start the mouthwash and they see they're doing fine and they stop it, they get into problems. Have you had that experience, and do you have that approach, or is she kind of overstating it?
I actually agree with Erica that the use of prophylactic mouthwash does make a big difference. We had a lot of experience using Dato-DXd, mostly actually in the early stage setting in the I-SPY trial. And as part of that trial, it was written into the protocol to use the prophylactic mouthwash. And I absolutely found that the patients that stuck with the prophylactic mouthwash did much better than those that sort of dropped off. Once you developed mucositis, it could sometimes be harder to walk it back. And so I now do counsel my patients to use it prophylactically, because better to not have problems than to sort of have to walk back the treatment once you develop them.
So another issue you mentioned about Dato relates to ophthalmic issues. And I have to say that, you know, I've always had questions. I'm trying to get, you know, trying to get an understanding about these issues. But I recently ran into your colleague, Neil Pasricha, and my whole world changed. My
he's
whole
amazing.
View of this changed. He is. So, you know, he's obviously a corneal specialist, and his whole, you know, thing there about the ADCs and the cornea and the fact that the keratocytes take that up, really fascinating. But, you know, again, there's a whole spectrum of issues. There are agents out there like belantamab mafodotin and myeloma, where the FDA had a big issue with the ophthalmic issues there. But in terms of data, from what he was saying to me, it seems like it's less of a problem, much less of a problem. What do you actually see? And you've had a lot of experience with Dato. Is it more just a little bit of dry eye and they take the eye drops, or do you need to kind of go beyond that?
That's very much been my experience, that most of my patients on Dato have had a little bit of dry eye. The risk of more severe keratitis in the trial was quite low. It is recommended in the label to have a patient see an ophthalmologist around the time of start, but there was it was very infrequent that I needed to send them back for a subsequent visit. We had patients use the just saline eye drops, and that really helped in this case.
Yeah, I got to say too, I have this little sort of joke with Neil about how is life without hope with a double entendre that you guys are trying to get used to.
I feel the same
hope
way.
Not
yes.
being,
it's yeah. sad. Yes.
So yeah, I guess she's still, I'm sure, in contact with you all the time now. But
yes,
Hope Rugo,
yes.
of course, just left your place to go to a City of Hope. So I want to get now kind of more into specifics in terms of sequencing. And I actually want to start out, we're going to get to your cases in a second, but let's start out with triple negatives. I can't wait to ask you a bit more about the Tropion study that you talked about that Sarah Tulaney presented, looking at sacituzumab plus pembro in the first line setting. I'm curious about what your thoughts are about it. Is that something you'd like to be able to use? Would you want to use it in every patient or in select patients? And then another question that I'm not sure how much has been discussed, but at least I've been thinking about it, is what do you do about people who've had prior neoadjuvant IO, you know, the 522 regimen?
Totally. Yeah, it's a great question. I'm very enthusiastic about moving SASE into the first line setting. I think we know that the prognosis, unfortunately, for our patients with metastatic triple negative disease is so dismal, and the opportunity to have a better PFS and hopefully we'll end up seeing an overall, we're waiting for the overall survival, but you can't bear to watch these patients do so poorly. So I think moving that forward is definitely a no-brainer in my mind. I think it is a question if they've gotten IO before, because in the trial, only 5% of patients received IO in the prior setting, whereas in the United States, especially with the KEYNOTE-522, like almost all of our patients are. I personally think I would continue the IO and the PD-L1 high if they haven't received it within a time period, or if they've only received part of it, you could just continue it on as long as they haven't had problems. But that is an area of open question at the moment based on the lack of those patients in that trial.
Do you foresee a day where, again, in the first-line setting, we're going to have a choice between Dato and SASE in the first-line setting?
I think likely, yes. I think I showed the two trials that we will likely see results from this year. One is first-line PD-L1 negative with Dato, and one is first-line PD-L1 with SASE. And I think it'll ultimately come down to, again, what the results look like from each of those trials and the side effect profile and the schedule, et cetera. So I think too soon to know, but exciting options.
So let's get into one of your cases. We brought up the issue of triple negative disease and first line therapy. We're waiting to see how that's going to play out. But let's get into one of your cases here, this 45-year-old woman. What happened with her?
Sure. So this is one of my patients who is 45, premenopausal, had a history of left breast cancer. So she was diagnosed in June of 2024 after she self-palpated a left breast mass, had a T3N1 disease on imaging that was biopsied as grade 3 invasive ductal carcinoma that was triple negative, a high Ki-67, and her lymph node was positive by biopsy as well. She did not have any germline pathogenic mutations, and she had staging imaging that didn't show metastatic disease. And so treated her in the neoadjuvant setting with the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. She tolerated it really well, got through that well, and then went to surgery in December of 2024, but unfortunately did have residual 2.1 centimeters of disease with a cellularity of 50%, and still did have 1 out of 5 positive lymph nodes. So that was RCB2 disease. They treated her with adjuvant radiation to the breast and axilla. She was continuing pembro and then added capecitabine. We were actually screening her for a trial to consider the use of an ADC in that setting. But sort of as this all developed, she developed left axillary fullness and unfortunately was found to have a new 2-centimeter liver lesion, which was biopsied as triple negative disease that was PD-L1 positive. And so she was started initially on sacituzumab govitecan. Even though this is her first line metastatic regimen, we typically, you know, although SG is approved in the second line setting, if you have early relapse, you can do it in the first line here. And of course, based on the data from ASCENT-04, I wanted to put it in the first line regardless. And then did actually opt to add pembrolizumab in her case after the ASCENT-04 data was presented. She hadn't gotten that much of her adjuvant pembro and so wanted to just continue that in her case. Unfortunately, just got a scan recently that showed that she is responding. She's tolerating the SASI pembro well. So I hope for the best for her. But I think a good example of potentially how we'll use SG pembro, I think, begs the question, like you said, of how much efficacy is the pembro adding if she's already received the pembro. We don't yet know, but I think in her case, I opted to continue it since she hadn't even continued the full adjuvant course yet.
So I guess one issue's question in a case like this is going to be what comes next if and when right. She does progress, which seems pretty likely. I see that she's, quote, HER2 negative. Does that mean HER2 zero or null?
She was HER2 IHC 1 plus. So, yeah, you would have the opportunity I should have said that there. You would have the opportunity to consider TDXD as a next therapy. I think it does come back to that question of ADC sequencing a bit. Should you do the TDXD as the next therapy or might you do, GemCarbo or Eribulin or some other chemotherapy in between and then do the TDXD after that? So I think it'll sort of depend on the situation. I tend to use the TDXD early, especially if she were to develop brain mets, for example. I would prioritize using the TDXD sooner. If she just has a little bit more progression in the liver, maybe I will do an intervening sandwich chemotherapy in between and then do the TDXD after that. So I think that's probably how I would sort of decide, but I certainly would want to give her TDXD in the future.
You know, your mentioning of brain mets is also important, and of course, now, in HER2 positive disease, it seems like people are actually using TDXD before the HER-CLIMB regimen, even now that the results are so impressive. What do we know about TDXD and, for that matter, the two TROP2 ADCs in terms of CNS activity? I did a program actually earlier today with Aaron Lisberg on ADCs in lung cancer, I think they've actually seen objective responses to dato in the brain. So I'm not sure whether we've seen the same thing with HER2 low with TDXD or sacituzumab. What do we know about this?
Yeah, great question. So we have a lot of data at this point that TDXD works very well in the brain. We saw the prospective DESTINY-Breast 12 trial presented by Nancy Lin last year at ESMO that showed very high intracranial responses, even in untreated brain mets. So I think that is definitely probably our best agent for CNS penetration. We have a little bit less data in breast specifically for SG and dato at the moment, but I think we have some. There was a nice study by Andrew Brenner looking at patients who were receiving sacituzumab govitecan before going to brain surgery, and they actually were able to, it was a window of opportunity study where they got some number of cycles and then went to surgery and they actually could detect the SN38 payload in the brain tissue. So, you know, there's definitely evidence that it's able to get there. And we've seen some responses in other tumor types with SG, and then there's been some retrospective case series. Sarah Salmon's had a nice case series in breast cancer specifically with SG as well. And then similarly in data, like you mentioned, there's some data in other tumor types. I think we have a little bit less at the moment in breast cancer specifically, but there's an ongoing trial called Database that's being specifically looking at CNS penetration with dato DXD in breast cancer. So I think I truly believe that all three do have CNS penetration and get into the brain. I think TDXD more so potentially than the other two based on our current data, but we'll get more data in the other two ADCs soon, hopefully.
So we do programs where we go out to the community and have general medical oncologists presenting cases from their practices. And we had a case a few weeks ago of a patient with triple negative breast cancer who actually was HER2 ultra low. Mm-hmm. And the doc wanted to know about, like, the patient kind of had run out of options and was in good shape about using TDXD in an ultra low hormone receptor negative situation. Yeah. Do we have? She wasn't aware. We weren't aware of any data on that. I'm curious. What do you have? Have you faced that situation? Have you used it? Have responses been reported?
Yeah, absolutely. I personally feel that all patients should see TDXD at some point if they have any amount of expression. And honestly, I've even used it in the null patients, citing the DAISY data, I think is the phase 2 DAISY trial looked at TDXD with HER2 null, 1+, 2+, 3+. And so there was a response rate of 20-something percent even in the null. And so that's often when I'm trying to get authorization, as I cite that trial specifically. I would feel very comfortable using TDXD in the ultra-low triple-negative patient. Based on sort of that data and experience so far, and I absolutely do use it in these patients. I prioritize the use of SG since there is more robust data with the ASCENT trial, but I certainly would want to give TDXD down the line as well.
Right, yeah. So, also, I'm kind of curious right now, once you get beyond these ADCs that we have that are approved and we have great data on, any clinical trials you have available right now, new agents, new ADCs, other therapies that you're excited about in the triple negative situation?
Yeah, I think there are a number of new ADCs in the triple negative setting that I'm excited about. We have the EMILY, the B7H4 ADC trial open at UCSF. There are a number of other trials with different combinations with immunotherapy. We have a TBCRC trial called 047 that's looking at the use of immunotherapy across the board, even in the PD-L1 negative population, avelumab plus SASE or chemotherapy. And then there's a lot of novel immunotherapy agents as well, and combining that either with ADCs or with chemotherapies and different types of combination strategies in that setting too. So I think a lot of movement that we'll hopefully see because this is such an area of unmet need that I'm very enthusiastic to enroll patients to trials in this setting.
So I want to get into your other case of a patient with HER2 positive, HER2 low disease. But first, just to take a step back in terms of ER positive disease. And again, you had such a great set of slides there looking at how you sequence therapy. One thing I was just kind of curious about in the hormone receptor positive patients is second line and beyond, but particularly second line therapy in terms of whether to even use second line endocrine therapy as opposed to going to chemotherapy. You kind of alluded to the issue of time on first line therapy with CDK inhibitors. I've heard people talk about 6 months. I think there's good data for a year, et cetera. But how do you go through thinking through that decision about whether you're going to use second line hormonal therapy versus chemo versus TDXD or an ADC? If a patient is symptomatic or has visceral disease, you think earlier about chemo or ADC?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do really try to optimize as much time on endocrine therapy as I can for my patients because often these agents are oral or intramuscular. They're better tolerated. And so I don't think we're doing our patients a service by jumping too soon to chemotherapy or ADCs. But I think it is always a question of once a patient, I try to get almost everyone, I think, to second line endocrine therapy if I can, but especially after second line, depending on how long they're on that, if they're on only that second line for 4 months and they have liver mets, I'm worried that their disease is too aggressive. That's when I need to move on to chemo versus if they were on that for 10 months and I might have another targeted therapy option to use in the third line, then I will try a third line endocrine therapy before going to chemo. I think as much time as I can on endocrine therapy, but keeping in mind, again, their disease parameters that might make me nervous and want to switch at some point sooner.
So I was going to say, what about the age-old question of, and I realize that age-old question has only been out there 3 years, but TDXD versus a TROP2 ADC in ER-positive, HER2-negative disease. We've been talking about that, of course, since the HER2-low data. Seems like so long ago, but it was actually 2022, right? It's only 3 years ago. It feels like that. Anyhow, and I remember literally we were doing a CME program like a few hours after the data was presented, and people already were talking about that question. Where are you today, or where are we today in that issue?
Yeah, so it's important to keep in mind we've never really compared these agents head to head, but I think we're doing a lot of this cross trial comparison to help us figure out the best sequencing. I personally, for hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, favor using T-DXd early, just because we saw such impressive PFS benefit, and the numbers there in terms of PFS and OS just look so good that I'll use T-DXd first as long as they don't have a contraindication, and then save the use of Dato-DXd or Sacituzumab Govitecan as a subsequent agent. Actually, the opposite is true in triple negative, where I think the ASCENT data looked really strong. It was a dedicated triple negative trial, whereas it was only 58 patients with T-DXd in the DB04 trial. So I do the opposite, where I prioritize, in general, sacituzumab govitecan first and then T-DXd second for triple negative. But there's individual patients where I switch it. Like I said, if someone has brain mets, I might switch the order and use T-DXd earlier. If someone is coming from really far and they will not on a 2-3 week regimen, I switch it earlier, or side effects. If someone has bad lung disease and I'm worried about T-DXd, or they're a smoker or something like that. You know, I think there's various reasons you might kind of switch the order or do things, but that's how I'm generally prioritizing it in each of those groups.
Right. And why don't we get into this case and we'll give a little more granularity to the question of this 57-year-old woman. What happened with her?
Sure. So this is a 57-year-old postmenopausal patient who had de novo hormone receptor positive, HER2 low, IHC 1 plus metastatic disease to bone, lymph node, and liver. So was biopsied, her liver biopsy confirmed the diagnosis and started her on an aromatase inhibitor plus ribociclib, which she was on for about 17 months until she had progression in the liver. And at that point, I sent a blood-based NGS test and found that she had a PIK3CA mutation. And so in the second line, opted to treat her with fulvestrant and capivasertib because of that PIK3CA mutation. Unfortunately, she didn't get as much time as I had hoped on that line, only got 4 months of therapy before she had, again, progression in the bone and the liver with some abdominal fullness, so some symptomatic component. And that's why in this particular patient, going back to that question of, you know, more endocrine therapy or switch, like I think I was only 4 months, I was worried about her amount of disease, and so I opted to switch towards using chemotherapy. And then in this case, I always ask, should I use something like capecitabine to ease in, or should I go straight to T-DXd and applying the DB06 data? And in this particular patient, I was more worried about her amount of disease. She was symptomatic, and so opted to use T-DXd as that first-line chemo based on the DESTINY-Breast06 data. And she was on that for a year, did really well, but then did progress again in the liver. And then I think at that point, I asked myself, do I want to do another ADC back-to-back? Like, would I give her, at the time, Dato-DXd wasn't even yet approved, but I could have given her sacituzumab govitecan or standard chemo, and opted to sort of do the sandwich approach in this particular patient where I gave her eribulin in between because of that kind of concern about cross-resistance. And then in the fifth line setting for that last patient, I talked to her both about SG and Dato-DXd. This patient comes from up kind of far north in Northern California, and so wanted to come less frequently if she could, and so opted to go with Dato-DXd, which I started several months ago now, and she's currently doing well. She's been on it for a little more than 3 months now with treatment ongoing. Her stable disease on her first scan. She's having a little bit of grade 1 stomatitis and grade 1 nausea, but she's using the prophylactic steroid mouthwash and the eye drops and tolerating it overall really well. So that was sort of how I thought through the ADC choices in this particular case.
So in terms of the stomatitis, first of all, is grade 1, it's asymptomatic, right?
Grade 1 is asymptomatic. At the moment, she has grade 1. So yeah, I guess I should have said she's had grade 2 previously, but now she's back to grade 1. So she sort of had on and off between grade 1 and grade 2.
And was she using the preemptive mouthwash when she started to develop this? And so you think she was using it? Interesting.
She was using it. She does admit to me that over the summer, she was a little bit more lax on using it, just with her travel and other things. And so I think that's actually when it kind of went into the grade 2. She was having a little bit more symptomatic disease. And then once we kind of got her back on the stomatitis improved. So I think we do kind of counsel people. Again, I think that's where I am a believer in the prophylactic use to sort of avoid the problem. Of course, it's hard for patients if they're traveling and busy to do the four times a day. And so sometimes even doing it three times a day or whatever kind of works for them, but not do trying to stay on it as much as possible.
Any thoughts in terms of future therapies for her if and when she does progress or future clinical trials?
Yeah, great question. I definitely prioritize clinical trials for patients if we have the option, since many of them sort of limit the number of prior therapies. And so depending on the situation, we have a clinical trial right now with disitamab vedotin and tucatinib for HER2-low, so I could consider her for that trial. But in terms of standard of care therapies, she actually hasn't yet seen a taxane therapy. So paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel would be an option. Gem-carbo would be an option. So I think that's sort of probably what I would think about next for her. And then I haven't yet actually treated a patient with all three ADCs. I think the concern about, you know, you could obviously leave sastuzumab govitecan on that list, but the cross-resistance concern, is there. So I might try another standard chemo or a different type of clinical trial before, considering SASI, but I would leave that on the list of future options as well.
Thinking about these ADCs that you've been talking about today in the metastatic setting, I'm curious where you see the things heading in terms of localized disease. And of course, you all are involved with the I-SPY series of trials that I always love those trials. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about some, including T-DXd as well as the two TROP2 ADCs in the localized neoadjuvant and the adjuvant setting?
Sure, yeah. So there are a number of trials ongoing looking at the use of ADCs. Some are in the neoadjuvant setting. So, for example, we presented data last year from I-SPY of Dato-DXd plus or minus durvalumab in that setting with four cycles. Patients could then go on to get standard chemo if needed before going to surgery. There's a dedicated phase 3 trial now looking at Dato-Durva 8 cycles head-to-head against the KEYNOTE-522 trial. So we'll see results from that trial coming. And there's other sort of neoadjuvant trials and data. We've seen data before from Laura Spring at Mass General looking at neoadjuvant sastuzumab govitecan. So there's been various neoadjuvant approaches and sort of some ongoing phase 3 trials. And then there's a number of also post-neoadjuvant settings. So in patients that have received the KEYNOTE-522 trial, for example, but have residual disease, we know that especially those with RCB2 and RCB3 residual disease, the prognosis is unfortunately, quite poor. And so how can we do better than our current standard of care being Pembro CAPE or Pembro or Laparib? But there's a number of trials that are randomizing patients. For example, we have a CENTO-5 open where you get either the control arm is Pembro CAPE versus Pembro sastuzumab govitecan in that setting. And so I think whether we end up using the ADCs more in the neoadjuvant or in the post-neoadjuvant for those that don't respond to treatment, I think we'll have to see how all of these trials pan out. But a lot of interest in moving the ADCs into that setting for sure.
Yeah, in terms of, what to expect there, kind of ties into also sort of this realization I've had over the last few months after years of, talking about ADCs and education sessions. It was only in the last few months that I started to really, I think, get it that in general, like almost every time you look at it, ADCs are better than chemo. The original sort of Trojan horse thing, I think a lot of people kind of put out of their mind, but it just seems like over and over, whenever you can compare, and not just breast cancer, obviously outside of breast cancer, that the thing actually, it actually works.
Totally. No, it's an amazing technology. And that's why I think having kind of flipping out the targets and the payloads to have even more options will be so key for our patients now that we're using more in sequence, especially.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I saw some interesting publications and work that you've done on leptomeningeal disease. Mm. I don't know if it's not necessarily related to ADCs, but I don't see too many people with some of the things on their CVs that you have, particularly, I think there was one with cell-free DNA and the, or was it circulating tumor cells
in
the
tumor
CSF?
Circulating.
So can you just maybe to finish out here, talk a little bit about some of the work you've done clinically and even in the lab looking at new approaches to leptomeningeal disease.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for asking. I think historically we've thought of leptomeningeal disease as sort of an end-stage complication of breast cancer where we can't do much. But because we have so many of these really effective agents, we're keeping patients alive much longer. It's sort of a growing problem. I have, you know, 5 or 6 patients right now in my practice that have LMD. Because they're alive for so long, we're seeing more and more of it. So I think it is actually a really important issue for clinicians to discuss. And a lot of our clinical trials exclude LMD, which is also a challenge. So we have a little bit less clinical trial data in this population. Speaking quickly of ADCs, though, I think we do have, there is some data that T-DXd works well for LMD. So that's sort of my go-to of the ADCs for patients with LMD. But I've also used both Dato and Sassy in patients with LMD as well because of that CNS penetration that we discussed before. So I think hopefully ADCs will sort of improve outcomes in this population. But in terms of our work, we've done a lot of work biobanking specimens from patients who are generously donating their CSF for research. And we're trying to understand, can we characterize the tumor cells in the CSF? And so we did some work with a company looking at, can you look at the ER expression, the HER2 expression? You know, we're using these drugs, for example, in HER2 low and ultra low, and maybe you're not detecting that relevantly in the periphery, but if their intracranial cells have more, you know, HER2 expression, should we be using different drugs, especially because of this complication of disease is so bad? And so better characterizing the tumor cells there, and then also better looking at the mutational profiles. So for example, sometimes we have some data where we got a simultaneous blood and CSF collection, and we detected a PIK3CA in centrally, but the PIK3CA wasn't detected peripherally. And now we have some of these CNS penetrant agents, the PIK3CA inhibitors in development, that go into the brain better. So I think we are learning more and more that there is heterogeneity in sites of disease, and we really do need to be able to sort of characterize the tumor cells in all of these separate domains, especially patients where that is their main site of disease. So we need to be able to target it in the best way possible.
Nowadays, are most people with leptomeningeal disease being diagnosed when they're asymptomatic through imaging or presenting with symptoms?
Yeah, it can really be either. The MRI technology is so much better that we are seeing some asymptomatic detection. But often, you know, these are patients that have some headache or balance issues or whatever other neurologic issue where you are finding it on, you know, we get an MRI for that purpose. There are imaging criteria based on MRI alone to diagnose LMD. So you don't have to get a spinal tap to check the CSF. I personally do think it's important to kind of confirm the diagnosis because it is such a challenging diagnosis for patients. And so I do like to get the LP to check the CSF cytology. But one of the problems with CSF cytology is the sensitivity and specificity is quite low. So you can get a negative on cytology, but you really clinically think they have LMD, which is another reason why sort of some of our novel technologies to sort of better detect these cells earlier will help us, I think, monitor a response and improve detection of LMD in the future as well.
Do you see people who have resolution of symptoms with LMD?
I've definitely had patients where, in fact, actually speaking of ADCs, I saw a patient in June who I walked into the clinic room, I knocked on the door, and she was in the dark because she was so dizzy that she couldn't even move. And I, at that point, I actually talked to her about, like, we could do hospice or we could consider T-DXd because she had, you know, confirmed LMD. And she's like, I'll try one dose of LMD, of T-DXd. And the next time I saw her, she looked like a different person. I didn't even recognize her. I was a transfer patient.
Wow.
So I think it's just, I think we have the ability to kind of turn things around for these patients. And so I think we need to remember that, including these patients in studies and better understanding their disease, especially as, again, it's more and more of a common issue as patients live longer.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Hubbard, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.